Farideh and Dr. A had talked a great deal about Mina, her knowledge, her commitment to literature, and to her work. There was a generosity to Farideh, which, despite her dogged commitment to what she called revolution, opened her up to certain people, even when they were ideological opponents. She had an instinct for picking out the rebels, the genuine ones, who, like Dr. A, or Mina, or Lale, disagreed with her political principles. So it was that she instinctively sympathized with Mina and tried to console her, although she disagreed with her on almost all counts. Mina had been recalled from a 2-year sabbatical at Boston University, where she'd gone to write her book. She was given an ultimatum, and she, in my opinion, had made a mistake in returning to Iran. Her book was on Henry James. She had studied under Leon Edel, and when I first saw her, it was difficult for her, quite an effort, to utter the simplest sentence. She, of course, never taught again. She came back to be expelled. She refused to wear the veil or to compromise. Her only compromise had been to return. And maybe that was not a compromise, but a necessity. Mina's father had been the poet laureate. Her family was cultured and well-off. Our families had gone on weekend outings together when we were young. She was older than me and never really talked to me during those family gatherings, but I remembered her vaguely. She's in some of the old photographs from my childhood, standing behind her father in their garden with one of her uncles and my father and a young man I cannot identify. She looks solemn, with the shadow of a conditional smile. Farideh and I tried to tell Mina how much we appreciated her, how outraged we were that the university did not. She listened impassively, but seemed to enjoy our esteem. Her favorite brother, the president of a large company, had been arrested at the start of the revolution. And like most, he refused to put up with the new regime. Although he was not politically active, he supported the monarchy, and like his sister, he spoke his mind, even in jail. He had been insolent, and that was enough. He was executed. Mina nowadays always dressed in black. Almost all her time in those days seemed to be devoted to her brother's widow and children. Mina lived alone with her mother in a ridiculously large mansion. The day Farideh and I went to visit her, each carrying a large bouquet of flowers, was a sunny day, clipped short as soon as we entered the mausoleum of her front hall. Her mother opened the door. She knew my parents and spent some time talking to me about them, and then abruptly but politely left us as soon as her daughter descended the winding staircase. We were standing at the bottom of the steps with our colorful bouquets and pastel dresses, looking too breezy and light in the face of the somber gravity of that house, which seemed to pull all things into its shadows. Mina's joys, the way she expressed her appreciation, were solemn. Yet she was very happy to see us, and she led us into the huge semicircle of her living room. The room seemed to have complaints of its own, like a widow appearing for the first time in public without her husband. It was sparsely furnished. There were empty spaces where there should have been chairs, tables, and a piano. Mina's mother, a dignified woman in her late 60s, served us tea on a silver tray, with dainty glass teacups in silver filigree containers. Her mother was a wonderful cook, so going to her house was always a feast. But it was a mournful feast, because no amount of good food could bring cheer to that deserted mansion. Our hostess's gracious hospitality, their efforts to make us feel welcomed, only made their well-concealed loss more emphatic. Realism in fiction was Mina's obsession, and James her passion. What she knew thoroughly. We complemented each other because my knowledge was impulsive and untidy, and hers meticulous and absolute. We could talk for hours on end. Before Farideh went into hiding and then joined her revolutionary group, escaping to Kurdistan and then to Sweden, the three of us used to talk about fiction and politics for hours, sometimes deep into the night. Farideh and Mina were polar opposites when it came to politics. One was a dedicated Marxist, and the other a determined monarchist. What they shared was their unconditional hatred for the present regime. When I think of how their talents were wasted, my resentment grows for a system that either physically eliminated the brightest and most dedicated, or forced them to lay waste to the best in themselves, transforming them into ardent revolutionaries like Farideh, or hermits like Mina and my magician. They withdrew and simmered in their dashed dreams. For what good could Mina be without her James? 19. The air attacks on Tehran were resumed after a long period of calm in the late winter and early spring of 1988. I cannot think of those months and of the 168 missile attacks on Tehran without thinking of the spring, of its peculiar gentleness. It was a Saturday when Iraq hit the Tehran oil refinery. The news triggered the old fears and anxieties that had been lurking for over a year since the last bombs had hit the city. The Iranian government responded with an attack on Baghdad, and on Monday, Iraq started its first round of missile attacks on Tehran. The intensity of what followed transformed that event into a symbol of all that I had experienced over the past 9 years, like a perfect poem. Soon after the first attacks, we decided to stick adhesive tape to our windows. We moved the children first to our own room, covering the windows in addition with thick blankets and shawls, and then later into the tiny windowless hall outside our bedrooms, the scene of my sleepless assignations with James and Nabokov. A few times, we thought seriously of leaving Tehran, and once in a frenzy, cleaned a small room that was later turned into my office near the garage, fortifying its windows. Then we moved back up to sleep in our own bedrooms. I, who had been most frightened during the first round of attacks on Tehran, now seemed the calmest, as if to compensate for my former behavior. On the first night of the missile attacks, we watched with a few friends a German TV documentary commemorating the life of the late exiled Russian director Andrei Tarkovsky. In an attempt to appease the intellectuals, the annual Fajr, formerly called Tehran Film Festival, presented a special screening of Tarkovsky's films. Although the films were censored and shown in the original Russian with no subtitles, there were lines outside the cinema hours before the box office opened. Tickets were sold on the black market at many times the actual price, and fights broke out over admittance, especially among those who had traveled from the provinces for the occasion. Mr. Forsati came to see me after one class to inform me that he had obtained two extra tickets to a showing of Tarkovsky's The Sacrifice, a film I had expressed some desire to see. Since Mr. Forsati was the head of Islamic Jihad, one of the two Muslim students' associations at the university, he had access to the coveted tickets. He said the Tarkovsky mania was so pervasive that even the oil minister and his family had gone to a screening. People were starved for films. He told me laughingly that the less they understood, the more they treated it with respect. I said, if that is the case, then they must love James. He responded shrewdly, that is different. They respect Joyce the way they respect Tarkovsky. With James, they think they understand him, or that they should understand him, so they just get angry. They have more problems with James than with the more obviously difficult writers like Joyce. I asked Mr. Forsati if he was going to see Tarkovsky. He said, if I do go, it is only to be a Roman in Rome. Otherwise, I much prefer Tom Hanks. The afternoon I went to see The Sacrifice was a fine winter day, and not really winter, a mixture of winter and spring. Yet the most amazing feature of the day was not the heavenly weather, not even the movie itself, but the crowd in front of the movie house. It looked like a protest rally. There were intellectuals, office workers, housewives, some with their small children in tow, a young mullah standing uncomfortably to the side, the kind of mix of people you would never have found at any other gathering in Tehran. Inside, the sudden burst of luminous colors on the screen brought a hushed silence over the audience. I had not been inside a movie theater for 5 years. All you could see in those days were old revolutionary movies from Eastern Europe or Iranian propaganda films. I cannot honestly say what I thought of the film. The experience of sitting in a movie house, ensconced in the deep, cool leather, with a full-size screen in front of me, was too amazing. Knowing that I could not understand the words, and that if I thought about the censorship, I would be too angry to watch, I surrendered to the magic of colors and images. Looking back on that time, it seems to me that such rapture over Tarkovsky, by an audience most of whom would not have known how to spell his name, and who would under normal circumstances have ignored or even disliked his work, arose from our intense sensory deprivation. We were thirsty for some form of beauty, even in an incomprehensible, over-intellectual abstract film with no subtitles and censored out of recognition. There was a sense of wonder at being in a public place for the first time in years without fear or anger, being in a place with a crowd of strangers that was not a demonstration, a protest rally, a bread line, or a public execution. The film itself was about war and about its hero's vow never to speak again if his family was spared from the ravages of war. It concentrated on the hidden menace behind the seemingly calm flow of everyday life and the lush beauty of nature, the way war made itself felt by the rattle of the furniture caused by the bomber planes and the terrible sacrifice required to confront this menace. For a brief time, we experienced collectively the kind of awful beauty that can only be grasped through extreme anguish and expressed through art. 20. In a period of 24 hours, 14 missiles hit Tehran. Since we had moved the children back to their room again, that night I pulled a small couch into their room and stayed awake reading until 3 in the morning. I read a thick Dorothy Sayers mystery, safe and secure, with Lord Peter Wimsey, his faithful manservant and his scholarly beloved. My daughter and I were woken up at dawn with the sound of a nearby explosion. It was not just the very loud noise, if one could call it a noise, of the explosion. More than the sound, we felt the explosion, like the fall of a massive weight on the house. The house shook, and the glass trembled in the window frames. After this last explosion, I got up and went upstairs to the terrace. The sky was blue and pink, the mountains capped with snow. At a distance, the smoke curled upwards from the fire where the missile had landed. From that day on, we resumed the routine that had been imposed on our daily lives during the bombing and missile attacks. After each explosion, there would be numerous phone calls to and from friends and relatives to find out if they were still alive. A savage relief, one of which I always felt a little ashamed, was inevitably triggered by the sound of familiar greetings. The general reaction in those days was a mixture of panic, anger, and helplessness. After 8 years of war, the Iranian government had done virtually nothing other than expand its propaganda effort to protect the city. It could only boast of the Iranian people's eagerness for martyrdom. After the first attack, the notoriously overpopulated and polluted city of Tehran had become a ghost town. Many people fled to safer places. I recently read in an account that over a quarter of the population, including many government officials, had deserted the city. A new joke making the rounds was that this was the government's most effective policy yet to deal with Tehran's pollution and population problems. To me, the city had suddenly gained a new pathos, as if under the attacks and the desertions, it had shed its vulgar veil to reveal a decent, humane face. Tehran looked the way most of its remaining citizens must have felt, sad, forlorn, and defenseless, yet not without a certain dignity. The adhesive tape, pasted on the window panes to prevent the implosion of shattered glass, told the story of its suffering, a suffering made more poignant because of its newly recovered beauty. The fresh green of trees washed by spring showers, the blossoms and the rising snow-capped mountains now so near as if pasted against the sky. 2 years into the war, Iran liberated the city of Khorramshahr, which had been captured by the Iraqis. In the context of other noticeable defeats, Saddam Hussein, encouraged by his worried Arab neighbors, had shown serious signs of reconciliation. But Ayatollah Khomeini and some within the ruling elite refused to sign a truce. They were determined now to capture the holy city of Karbala in Iraq, the site of martyrdom of Imam Hussein. Any and all methods were used to achieve their purposes, including what became known as human wave attacks, where thousands of Iranian soldiers, mainly very young boys ranging in age from 10 to 16, and middle-aged and old men, cleared the minefields by walking over them. The very young were caught up in the government propaganda that offered them a heroic and adventurous life at the front and encouraged them to join the militia, even against their parents' wishes. My vigils at night with Dashiell Hammett and others resumed. The result was that 4 years later, I added a new section to my class, The Mystery Tale, beginning with Edgar Allan Poe. 21. With the resumption of the bombing, we moved our classes to the second floor. Every time there was an attack, people impulsively ran to the door and down the stairs. It was safer to move the classes downstairs. The new emergency had emptied the classrooms, so most were now half full. Many students went back to their hometowns or to towns and cities that were not under attack. Some simply stayed home. The renewal of bombing had made people like Mr. Qomi more important. They came and went after this with a new sense of urgency. The Islamic associations used every opportunity to disrupt the classes, playing military marches to announce a new victory or to mourn for a member of the university community who had been martyred in the war. Midway through a passage from Washington Square or Great Expectations, suddenly the sound of the military march would take over, and after that, no matter how hard we tried to continue, all attempts at discussion were conquered by the march. This boisterous cacophony was in marked contrast to the silence of the majority of the students and staff. I was actually surprised that more students didn't use these events as an excuse to cut classes or to refrain from doing their homework. Their seeming docility reflected a larger mood of resignation in the city itself. As the war raged on, with no victories into the eighth year, signs of exhaustion were apparent, even among the most zealous. By now in the streets and in public places, people expressed anti-war sentiments or cursed the perpetrators of the war. While on television and radio, the regime's ideal continued to play itself out undeterred. The recurrent image in those days was that of an elderly, bearded, turbaned man calling for unceasing jihad to an audience of adolescent boys with red martyrs' bands stretched across their foreheads. These were the dwindling remainders of a once vast group of young people who had been mobilized by the excitement of carrying real guns and the promise of keys to a heaven where they could finally enjoy all the pleasures from which they had abstained in life. Theirs was a world in which defeat was impossible, hence compromise meaningless. The mullahs would regale us with stories of the unequal battles in which the Shia saints had been martyred by infidels, while at times breaking into hysterical sobs, whipping their audience into a frenzy, welcoming martyrdom for the sake of God and the Imam. In contrast, the world of the viewers was one of silent defiance, a defiance that was meaningful only in the context of the raucous commitment demanded by the ruling hierarchy, but otherwise permeated inevitably and historically by resignation. Life in death, the death wish of the regime, and the obliging missiles of Iraq could only be tolerated when one knew that the missile would deliver the final message at a moment exactly predetermined and that there was no point in trying to escape it. It was during these days that I realized what this silent resignation meant. It reflected the much maligned mysticism that we all held responsible, at least in part, for our country's historical failures. I understood then that this resignation was perhaps, under the circumstances, the only form of dignified resistance to tyranny. We could not openly articulate what we wished, but we could, by our silence, show our indifference to the regime's demands. 22. I can still hear the mourning and victory marches that disrupted so many classes to announce the death of a student or staff member in the line of duty or some victory of the Army of Islam over its heathen foe. No one bothered to point out that the heathen foe in this warfare were fellow Muslims. The day I have in mind, the march was playing to commemorate the death of one of the leaders of the Muslim Students Association. After class, I joined a few of my girls who were standing together outside in the yard. They were making fun of the dead student and laughing. They joked that his death was a marriage made in heaven. Didn't he and his comrades say that their only beloved was God? This was an allusion to the last wills and testaments made by the martyrs of the war, which were given a great deal of publicity. Almost all claimed that death by martyrdom was their highest desire because it promised them ultimate union with their true beloved. Oh yeah, sure, God, the girls were laughing. God in the guise of all the women he devoured with his eyes before he filed complaints against them for indecency. This was how he got his kicks. They are all sexual perverts, the whole lot of them. Nasreen started to tell a story about a teacher of religion in her 12-year-old cousin's school. This teacher instructed her students to cover themselves and promised them that in paradise they would get their just reward. There in paradise they would find streams running with wine and would be wooed by strong, muscular young men. Her fat lips seemed to be drooling when she spoke about the muscular young men that, like prize lamb, she could already see, cooked to perfection. I think something in my rather shocked expression stopped the flow of their mirth. I had not known the young martyr, and if I had, I would most likely not have been fond of him. But this air of jubilation was still shocking. They felt some explanation was necessary. "You don't know him," Mojgan told me. "Next to him, Mr. Qumi is an absolute angel." He was sick, sexually sick. You know he got a friend expelled because he said the white patch of skin, just barely visible under her scarf, sexually provoked him. They were like hounds. Then Nasreen jumped in with a screed about one of the female guards. Her searches were like sexual assaults, she insisted. One day, she squeezed and fondled Niloufar until she became hysterical. "They expel us for laughing out loud, but you know what they did to this woman when she was discovered? She was reprimanded, expelled for a semester, and then she was back at her job." Later I told Nasreen that as I watched them mocking the dead student, a poem by Bertolt Brecht kept running through my mind. I don't remember it well. It went something like, "Indeed we live in dark ages, where to speak of trees is a sort of a crime." I wish I could remember the poem better, but there is a line towards the end, something like, "Alas, we who wanted kindness could not be kind ourselves." Nasreen was quiet for a moment after that. "You don't know what we have suffered," she said at last. "Last week, they dropped a bomb near our house. It fell on an apartment building. The neighbors said that in one of the flats, there was a birthday party, and some 20-odd children were killed. Immediately after the bombs fell, and before the ambulances came, 6 or 7 motorcycles arrived from out of nowhere and started circling the area. The riders all wore black with red headbands across their foreheads. They started shouting slogans, 'Death to America, death to Saddam, long live Khomeini.' People were very quiet. They just watched them with hatred. Some tried to go forward to help the wounded, but the thugs wouldn't let anyone go near the place. They kept shouting, "War, war, until victory." How do you think we all felt as we stood there watching them? This was a ritual. After the bombings, these emissaries of death would prevent any sign of mourning or protest. When two of my cousins were killed by the Islamic regime, some of my relatives, who were now on the side of the government, called my uncle to congratulate him on the death of his son and daughter-in-law. We exchanged stories as we walked that day. Nasreen told me more about her time in jail. The whole thing was an accident. I remember how young she had been, still in high school. She said, "You're worried about our brutal thoughts against them, but you know most of the stories you hear about the jails are true. The worst was when they called people's names in the middle of the night. We knew they had been picked for execution. They would say goodbye, and soon after that, we would hear the sound of bullets. We would know the number of people killed on any given night by counting the single bullets that inevitably came after the initial barrage. There was one girl there. Her only sin had been her amazing beauty. They brought her in on some trumped-up immorality charge. They kept her for over a month and repeatedly raped her. They passed her from one guard to another. That story got around jail very fast because the girl wasn't even political. She wasn't with the political prisoners. They married the virgins off to the guards who would later execute them. The philosophy behind this act was that if they were killed as virgins, they would go to heaven. You talk of betrayals. Mostly, they forced those who had converted to Islam to empty the last round into the heads of their comrades as tokens of their new loyalty to the regime. If I were not privileged, she said with rancor, if I were not blessed with a father who shared their faith, God knows where I would be now. In hell would all the other molested virgins, or would those who put a gun to someone's head to prove their loyalty to Islam. 23. On August 4th, 1914, Henry James added an entry to his journal. He wrote, "Everything blackened over for the time, blighted by the hideous public situation. This is Monday, the August bank holiday, but with horrible suspense and the worst possibilities in the air." In his last 2 years of life, Henry James was radically transformed by his intense involvement in the First World War. For the first time, he became socially and politically active. A man who all his life had done his best to keep aloof from the actual passions of existence. His critics, like H.G. Wells, blamed him for his Mandarin attitude towards life, which prevented him from any involvement with the social and political issues of the day. He wrote about his experiences of World War I that it almost killed me. I loathed so having lived on and on into anything so hideous and horrible. When still very young, James had witnessed the Civil War in America. Physically, he was prevented from participating in a war in which his two younger brothers fought with courage and honor by a mysterious backache acquired on a mission to rescue a burning barn. Psychologically, he kept the war at bay by writing and reading. Perhaps his frenetic activities to support and aid the British in World War I were partly to compensate for his earlier inactivity. It is also true that the war that had evoked his horror mesmerized him. He wrote to a friend, but I have an imagination of disaster and see life as ferocious and sinister. In his youth, James wrote to his father that he was convinced of the transitory organization of the actual social body. The only respectable state of mind is to constantly express one's perfect dissatisfaction with it. And in his best works of fiction, this is what he did. In almost all of his novels, the struggle for power is central to the way the plot moves and is resolved. This struggle for power is rooted in the central character's resistance to socially acceptable norms and in his desire for integrity and recognition. In Daisy Miller, the tension between the old and the new leads to Daisy's death. In The Ambassadors, it is Mrs. Newsom's almost awesome power and pressure over her ambassador and her family that creates the central tension in the plot. It is interesting to note that in this struggle, the antagonist always represents worldly concerns, while the protagonist's desire is to preserve a sense of personal integrity in the face of outside aggression. During the Civil War, when James was discovering his own powers, he wrote in part to compensate for his inability to participate in the war. Now, at the end of his life, he complained about the impotence of words in the face of such inhumanity. In an interview on March 21, 1915, with the New York Times, he said, "The war has used up words. They have weakened. They have deteriorated like motor car tires. They have, like millions of other things, been more overstrained and knocked about and voided of the happy semblance during the last 6 months than in all the long ages before. And we are now confronted with a depreciation of all our terms, or otherwise speaking, with a loss of expression through increase of limpness that may well make us wonder what ghosts will be left to walk." Despite his despair, he turned to words again, this time to write not fiction, but war pamphlets, appeals to America to join the war, and not to remain indifferent to the suffering and atrocities in Europe. He also wrote poignant letters. In some, he expressed his horror at events. In others, he consoled friends who had lost a son or a husband in the war. He fell into a round of activities, visiting wounded Belgian soldiers and later British soldiers in hospitals, raising money for Belgian refugees and the wounded, and writing war propaganda from the fall of 1914 until December 1915. He also accepted the post of honorary head of the American Volunteer Motor Ambulance Corps and joined the Chelsea Fund for Belgian refugees. All these were whirlwind activities for a shy and reclusive writer whose most ardent pursuits and passions had previously been reserved for his fiction. As his biographer, Leon Edel, would later say, "The world seemed to find too much comfort in him, and he had to often protect himself against its weeping too profusely on his shoulders." While visiting the hospitals, James likened himself to Whitman visiting the wounded during the Civil War. He said, "It made him feel less finished and doddering when I go on certain days and try to pull the conversational cart uphill for them." What inner horror and fascination drove this man, who all his life had shied away from public activity, to become so actively involved in the war effort? One reason for his involvement was the carnage, the death of so many young men, and the dislocation and destruction. While he mourned the mutilation of existence, he had endless admiration for the simple courage he encountered, both in the many young men who went to war and in those they left behind. In September, James moved to London. He wrote, "I can hear and see and have informational contact." He added, "I eat my heart out alone." He lobbied the U.S. ambassador to Britain and other high American officials and reproached them for their neutrality. And he wrote pamphlets in defense of Britain and her allies. James emphasized in his many letters one important resource to counter the senselessness of the war. He was aware, as many were not, of the toll such cruelty takes on emotions and of the resistance to compassion that such events engender. In fact, this insensitivity becomes a way of survival. As in his novels, he insisted on the most important of all human attributes, feeling, and railed against what he called the paralysis of my own powers to do anything but increasingly and inordinately feel. Years later, on a pink index card I carried across the oceans from Tehran to Washington, D.C., I found two quotations about James's wartime experiences. I had written them out for Nasreen, but I never showed them to her. The first was from a letter he wrote to Claire Sheridan, a friend whose husband, they were newly married, had gone to war and been killed. He wrote, "I am incapable of telling you not to repine and rebel, because I have so, to my cost, the imagination of all things, and because I am incapable of telling you not to feel. Feel, feel, I say, feel for all your worth, and even if it half kills you, for that is the only way to live, especially to live at this terrible pressure, and the only way to honor and celebrate these admirable beings who are our pride and our inspiration." In letters to friends again and again, he urges them to feel. Feeling would stir up empathy and would remind them that life was worth living. One of the peculiarities of James's reaction to the war was the fact that his feelings and emotions were not aroused for patriotic reasons. His own country, America, was not at war. Britain, the country where he had lived for 40 years, was. But in all those 40 years, he had not asked for British citizenship. Now, he finally did. In June 1915, a few months before his death, Henry James was granted British nationality. He had written to his nephew Harry that he wished to make his civil status compatible with his moral and material status. He wrote, "Hadn't it been for the war, I should certainly have gone on as I was, taking it as the simplest and easiest and even friendliest thing. But the circumstances are utterly altered now." His more immediate reason for this sudden reversal was that because of wartime conditions, he had been categorized as a friendly alien and needed police permission every time he traveled from London to his home in Sussex. But the more important and symbolic reason was his disenchantment with America's distance from the war. He wrote to a friend, Lily Perry, that the immediate presence of the enemy transforms it from head to foot when one's own nationality does nothing for one that keeps pace with transformation. The truth is that James, like many other great writers and artists, had chosen his own loyalties and nationality. His true country, his home, was that of the imagination. Black and hideous to me is the tragedy that gathers, he wrote to his old friend Rhoda Brofton. And I'm sick beyond cure to have lived to see it. You and I, the ornaments of our generation, should have been spared this wreck of our belief that these long years we had seen civilization grow and the worst became possible. He had written to Edith Wharton of this crash of civilization. The only gleam in the blackness to me is the action and the absolute unanimity of this country. James's idea of home was bound up with the idea of civilization. In Sussex, during the war, he found it difficult to read and impossible to work. He described himself as living under the funeral spell of our murdered civilization. When in September 1914, the Germans attacked and destroyed the Reims Cathedral in France, James wrote, "But no words fill the abyss of it, nor touch it, nor relieve one's heart, nor light by a spark the blackness. The ache of one's heart and the anguish of one's execution aren't mitigated by a shade, even as one brands it as the most hideous crime ever perpetuated against the mind of man." All his life had been a struggle for power, not political power, which he disdained, but the power of culture. For him, culture and civilization were everything. He had said that the greatest freedom of man was his independence of thought, which enabled the artist to enjoy the aggression of infinite modes of being. Yet in the face of so much carnage and destruction, he felt helpless and impotent. His affinity with England and with Europe in general came from that sense of civilization, a tradition of culture and humaneness. But now he had also seen Europe's depravity, its fatigue with its own past, its predatory, cynical nature. It is no wonder he used all his powers, not least the power of words, to help those he believed to be in the right. He was not insensitive to their curative potential and wrote to a friend, Lucy Clifford, "We must for dear life make our own counter-realities." 24. A few days after my talk with Nasreen, I found two girls standing outside my office just before class. One was Nasreen, with her usual pale smile. The other was dressed in a black chador that covered her from head to foot. After staring at this apparition for a while, I suddenly recognized my old student, Mahtab. For a second, all three of us stood there, frozen in place. Nasreen seemed almost detached. Detachment had become her defense against unpleasant memories and uncontrollable realities. It took me a few moments to digest this new Mahtab, to make a shift in my mind and transform that Mahtab, the leftist student in her trademark khaki pants, whom I had last seen on the grounds of a hospital hunting for her murdered comrades, to this Mahtab, standing with a rueful smile and begging recognition outside my office. I made an uncertain gesture as if to embrace her, but then checked myself and asked her how she had been all these years. Only then did I remember to invite them into my office. I had very little time before my next class. Mahtab had kept in touch with Nasreen, and when she'd heard I was teaching again at Allameh, she had plucked up the courage to come and visit. Could she attend my class? And then perhaps after class, if I had time, if it wasn't a problem, she could tell me a little about herself. Of course, I said. She should absolutely come to class. During the 2 hours of my lecture on James's Washington Square, my eyes often strayed to Mahtab in her black chador, sitting very straight, listening with a sort of alert nervousness I had never seen in her before. After class, she followed me to my office with Nasreen trailing in after her. I asked them to sit down and offered them some tea, which they both refused. Ignoring their refusal, I left to order tea and came back and closed the door to ensure our privacy. Mahtab sat on the edge of a chair while Nasreen stood beside her, staring at the opposite wall. I told Nasreen to take a seat because she was making me nervous and turned to Mahtab and asked her in as casual a tone as I could muster what she had been doing all these years. She looked at me at first with docile resignation, as if she had not understood my question. Then she fiddled with her fingers, half hidden under the folds of her chador, and said, "Well, I have been where Nasreen was. Shortly after the day I saw you at the demonstrations, I was arrested. They gave me only 5 years, which was lucky. They knew I was no big shot in our organization. And then I was let off early. I got out after 2.5 years for good behavior." She left me to guess what good behavior meant to the kind of people who had put her in jail. There was a knock at the door and Mr. Latif entered with the tea. We all paused until he left the room. "I did think of you and of our classes," she said after he had left. After the initial interrogations, she had been assigned to a cell with 15 others. There, she had met another student of mine, Razieh. Balancing the small cup of tea I had offered her in one hand, without letting her chador slip, she said, "Razieh told me about your classes on Hemingway and James at Al-Zahra, and I told her about the Gatsby trial. We laughed a lot. You know, she was executed." "I was lucky," she said. Less than a year after she was released from prison, Mahtab had married and had a baby. She was expecting another one, 3 months pregnant. "It doesn't show from under the chador," she said, pointing shyly to her stomach. There was nothing I could ask her about my murdered student. I did not want to know how they had lived in their cell, what other memories they had shared. I felt that if she told me, I might do something foolish and would not make it to my afternoon class. I asked her about her baby's age, but not about her husband. Could I ask her my favorite question? "Did you two fall in love?" I had heard about so many girls who had married soon after their release from jail, married because they could appease the suspicions of their jailers, who somehow thought of marriage as an antidote to political activities, or to prove to their parents that they were good girls now, or simply because there was nothing else for them to do. You know, I always thought Gatsby was so beautiful, Mahtab told me as she was getting up to go. And the scene you read to us about that day when Daisy meets Gatsby again for the first time in 5 years, her face wet under the rain. And the other scene when she tells him he looks so cool and she means to say that she loves him. We had fun at Gatsby's trial, you know. Yes, I knew. The fact that they remembered Gatsby and even remembered having fun with him would have been gratifying under different circumstances. But then I was thinking, among other thoughts, how the joy of reading Gatsby would now be forever marred by being linked in my memory with Mahtab's time in jail and Rozier's execution. I felt I had to open the window to let the air in after they were gone. From my office, I could see the yard where snow almost caressed the trees. There was a heaviness Mahtab had left behind, a tangible atmosphere of pain and resignation. Was she the lucky one? The one who was released and got married to some guy? The one who reported to the prison guards every month? The one with a hometown in ruin and a 2-year-old child? She was lucky, and Rozier was dead. Nasreen had also called herself lucky. My students had developed a strange concept of fortune. The other quotation from James on the pink index card records his reaction to the death of Rupert Brooke, the beautiful young English poet who died of blood poisoning during the war. James wrote that, "I confess I have no philosophy, nor piety, nor patience, no art of reflection, no theory of compensation to meet things so hideous, so cruel, and so mad. They're just unspeakably horrible and irremediable to me, and I stare at them with angry and almost blighted eyes." Next to the last words, I added at some later point in pencil, "Rozier." 25. What strange places my students met. From what dark corners did they bring me news? I could not travel. I cannot travel even now to those places, no matter how many times I hear about them. Yet there must have been something cheerful about Rozier and Mahtab in their cell, not knowing if they will live or die, talking about James and Fitzgerald. Perhaps cheerful is not the right word. I mention this because it is not where I had imagined they would take my favorite novels, my golden emissaries from that other world. I think of Rozier in that jail, and of Rozier facing the firing squad on some night, perhaps the same night I was reading The Long Goodbye or The Bostonians. I remember now, as I did then, that one of the most surprising things about Rozier was her love of James. I remember the class I taught at Al-Zahra University and all its frustrations. The distinguishing feature of this so-called university was that it was the only all-girls college in Iran. It had a small campus with a beautiful and leafy garden, and I taught 2 courses there while also teaching at the University of Tehran in the first year after my return. I was shocked when grading the midterm exams, I noticed that most of the class, rather than respond to the questions, had simply repeated my classroom lectures. In 4 cases, this repetition was amazing. They had transcribed, seemingly word for word, what I had said about a farewell to arms, including my "you knows" and my digressions about Hemingway's personal life. Reading these exam papers, I felt I had been given a bizarre parody of my own lectures. I thought they had cheated. It was inconceivable to me that they could have recreated my lectures so precisely without notes. My colleagues, however, informed me that this was regular practice. The students memorized everything their teachers said and gave it back to them without changing a word. At the next class after that exam, I was furious. It was one of the only times in my teaching career that I got angry and showed it in class. I was young and inexperienced, and I thought certain standards were expected and understood. I remember I told them, It would have been better if they had cheated. At least, cheating required a certain ingenuity. But to repeat my lecture word for word, to include not so much as a glimmer of themselves in their response, I went on, and as I continued, I became more righteous in my indignation. It was the sort of anger one gets high on, the kind one takes home to show off to family and friends. They were all silent, even those who had not committed the sins I had attributed to them. I dismissed the class early, although the culprits and a few others stayed behind to plead their case. They were docile, even in their pleas. They wanted to be forgiven. They didn't know any better. This was what most professors expected. Two were in tears. What could they do? They had never learned any better. From the first day they had set foot in elementary school, they had been told to memorize. They had been told that their own opinions counted for nothing. Razia stayed until they had all left. Then she told me she wanted to talk to me. "It isn't their fault," she said. "I mean, it is in a way, but I always thought you were one of those who cared." The echo of reproach in her voice startled me. Would I have been so angry if I didn't care? "Yes, that is the easy way," she said quietly. "But you must think about where we are coming from. Most of these girls have never had anyone praise them for anything. They have never been told that they are any good or that they should think independently. Now you come in and confront them, accusing them of betraying principles they have never been taught to value. You should have known better." There she was, this small girl, my student, lecturing me. She couldn't have been more than 20, but somehow she managed to look authoritative without being impertinent. "They love this class," she said. "They even learned to love Catherine Sloper, though she isn't pretty and lacks everything they look for in a heroine." I said, "In these revolutionary times, it's hardly surprising that students wouldn't care much about the trials and tribulations of a plain, rich American girl at the end of the 19th century." But she protested vehemently. "In these revolutionary times," she said, "they care even more. I don't know why people who are better off always think that those less fortunate than themselves don't want to have the good things, that they don't want to listen to good music, eat good food, or read Henry James." She was a slight girl, slight and dark. Her seriousness must have been a burden to her fragile frame. Even so, she wasn't frail. How a person this fragile-looking could give an impression of such solidity, I don't know. Razia. I don't remember her last name. But her first name I can use without having to worry about security, because she is dead. It seems ironic that I should only be able to use the real names of dead people. She had the respect of her classmates, and in those deeply ideological times was listened to by girls from both ideological extremes. She was an active member of the Mujahideen, but this didn't keep her from being suspicious of their cant. She had no father, and her mother earned her living as a cleaning woman. Both Razia and her mother were deeply religious, and it was her religious belief that attracted her to the Mujahideen. She felt contempt for the Islamists who had usurped power. Razia had an amazing capacity for beauty. She said, "You know, all my life I have lived in poverty. I had to steal books and sneak into movie houses. But God, I loved those books. I don't think any rich kid has ever cherished Rebecca or Gone with the Wind the way I did when I borrowed the translations from houses where my mother worked. But James, he is so different from any other writer I have ever read. I think I'm in love, she added, laughing. Razier was such a strange mixture of contradictory passions. She was bitter and determined, stern and tough, and yet she loved novels and writing with a real passion. She said she did not wish to write, but to teach. She was an inarticulate writer. She said, "We envy people like you, and we want to be you. We can't, so we destroy you." After I left that college, I saw her only once. I think she felt that by leaving their small college to teach at the University of Tehran, I had abandoned them. I asked her to come to my classes to keep in touch, but she never did. A few months after the bloody demonstration in the summer of 1981, I was walking down a wide, sunny street near the University of Tehran when, coming from the opposite direction, I saw a figure wrapped in a black chador, a small figure. The only reason I paid attention to her at all was that she paused for a second, startled. It was Razier. She did not say hello. And in her look, I could see a denial, a plea not to be recognized. We glanced at each other and passed. I will never forget that glance on that day, and her so very thin, small body, her narrow face and large eyes, like an owl's or an imp's in some invented tale. 26. In memory of my student Razier, I will now digress and talk about her favorite book. I shall consider this an in memoriam. What was it about Washington Square that had so intrigued Razier? True, there had been identification. She did see something of herself in its hapless heroine. But it was not that simple. Washington Square seems straightforward enough, yet the characters cheat you. They act contrary to expectation, beginning with Catherine Sloper, the heroine. Catherine is trapped by her clever and materially successful father, who ignores her with contempt. He never forgives his devoted and shy daughter for the loss of his beloved wife, who died in childbirth. Moreover, he cannot get over his disappointment at Catherine's failure to be brilliant and beautiful. Catherine is also entrapped by her love of Maurice Townsend, the beautiful, her word, young spendthrift who woos and courts her for her money. Mrs. Pennyman, her shallow, sentimental, and meddling widowed aunt, who tries to appease Catherine's romantic aspirations by proxy through matchmaking, completes the evil triumvirate. Catherine is an exceptional heroine, even for James. She is the inverse of our ideas of what a heroine should be. Hefty, healthy, plain, dull, literal, and honest. She's squeezed in between three colorful, clever, egocentric characters who abuse and underestimate her while she remains loyal and good. One by one, James strips away from Catherine the qualities that make a heroine attractive. What he takes away from her, he distributes among the other three characters. To Maurice Townsend, he bestows beauty and brilliance. to Mrs. Pennyman a Machiavellian love of intrigue, and to Dr. Sloper he gives irony and judgment. But at the same time, he deprives them of the single quality that distinguishes his heroine, compassion. Like many heroines, Catherine is wrong. She has a gift for self-deception. She believes that Morris loves her and refuses to believe her father's protestations to the contrary. James didn't like his heroes and heroines to be infallible. In fact, they all make mistakes, harmful mostly to themselves. Their mistakes, like the tragic flaw in a classical tragedy, become essential to their development and maturity. Dr. Sloper, the most villainous of the three, is also the most correct. He is correct in his professional and in his private life, and he makes all the right prognostications about his daughter, or almost all. He correctly, and with his usual touch of irony, predicts that Mrs. Pennyman will try to persuade his daughter that some young man with a mustache is in love with her. It will be quite untrue. No young man, with a mustache or without, will ever be in love with Catherine. From the beginning, Dr. Sloper doubts Morris Townsend's honorable intentions towards his daughter and does his best to prevent their marriage. But what he can never penetrate is his daughter's heart. She constantly surprises him because he does not really know her. He underestimates Catherine, but he does something worse. His failure is a failure of the heart. For Catherine's heart must be broken twice. Once by her alleged lover, and then by her father. He is guilty of the same crime of which he accuses Morris, namely, lack of love for his daughter. Thinking of Dr. Sloper, we are reminded of one of Flaubert's insights. Flaubert wrote, "You should have a heart in order to feel other people's hearts." And I was immediately reminded of poor Mr. Gomi, who missed all these subtleties, or rather, fortunate Mr. Gomi, for whom no such scruples existed. In his book, a daughter must obey her father, and that was the end of the story. Dr. Sloper never sees his daughter's needs. He complains about her lack of accomplishment, yet never observes her hidden yearnings for music and theater. He sees her foolishness, but misses her intense longing to be loved. It is not an accident that in her first meeting with Morris Townsend at her cousin's wedding, Catherine, we are told, who has suddenly developed a lively taste for dress, wears a red satin dress. The narrator informs us that her great indulgence was really the desire of a rather inarticulate nature to manifest itself. She sought to be eloquent in her garments and to make up for her diffidence of speech by a fine frankness of costume. The dress is a disaster. The color does not suit her and makes her look 10 years older. It is also the subject of her father's wittiest remarks. That same night, Catherine meets Morris and falls in love. Twice, her father misses his chance to understand and help her.